The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'm going to talk about Clara Zetkin and Mike about Lenin, and Jen is going to do a critique of what we say. it's really a study of how major political figures operate in a very tense and contradictory situation. In that sense, it has similarities to the world we live in. The conditions are different, but the kind of dilemmas they faced are the kind of things we face in our political work. Now, the Third Congress of the Communist International, which we are discussing, took place in Moscow in 1921, and it was remarkable in its unpredictability. That is, the political currents intersected in an unexpected fashion, and individual figures and their decisions at turning points carried great weight. And today we will consider two of these figures, as I said, Zetkin and Lenin. Now I find Zetkin, how many of you know who Clara Zetkin was? Pretty much, not everybody. Clara Zetkin was the oldest major figure in the Communist International and had been a leader of the revolutionary wing of socialism for many decades, in addition to being the leading proponent of the socialist women's movement. I find her an outstanding and heroic figure. She acted as the main spokesperson for a much criticized minority in the German Communist Party at the time. And this minority's positions were ultimately in large measure adopted by the Third Congress. She lived at a time when women still played a marginal role in the workers' movement. Few women were employed, few belonged to workers' parties. Their role in these parties was mainly administrative, an extension in the sense of their domestic duties. The communist movement was far in the lead in opening the door to women's activists and advocating women's rights, but it was still marked by some of the prejudices of the surrounding society. Zetkin had won a role as probably the Comintern's best known and most respected figure outside Russia. Comintern, short for Communist International. Yet her prominence aroused mixed feelings among some of her comrades in the world movement, as we'll see. Let us trace her role through four major turning points just before the Congress and at it. Try to put yourself in her shoes. Would you have acted as she did, or would you have acted in a different manner? And then in the discussion period, say what you think. Now, I'm not going to say what I think. I'll leave it to you. Now, the first of these four points was a split among the Italian socialists that divided the German leaders. And that took place a few months before the Congress. The split between a left wing loyal to the Communist International and an anti-revolutionary minority. Unfortunately, the split was carried out in an abrupt manner, and most of the members sympathetic to the Comintern ended up tied to the right wing, the opportunists, rather than to the Communist International. Zetkin believed that this unfavorable outcome was largely the result of a harsh and ill-informed intervention by emissaries of the Comintern's executive committee, that I will generally just call the executive. In letters to Lenin, she said this was an ongoing problem, and she pleaded for more respect for National Party's autonomy. Meanwhile, some executive members, like Karl Radek, had been intriguing privately with leftists in the German party to undermine its central leader, Paul Levy, with whom Zetkin was associated, and to shift the party to a more radical course. Activating the party was his term. These tensions found expression in the German leaders' debate over the Italian split. Executive emissaries secured the defeat of Levy, Zetkin, and their colleagues, the previous leadership, on this issue. Levy, Zetkin, and three other leaders in the political committee, that is the day-to-day leadership body, took this as a vote of non-confidence and resigned in protest. A new, more leftist team took over. The executive had thus used its authority to oust an elected national leadership, just what Zetkin had warned against. She had to protest, but her resignation was condemned as an act of desertion. So, question one, was her resignation justified? Okay. Number two, the March action. A new leadership took charge, and soon, with much encouragement from executive emissaries, this leadership launched the German party into a confrontational general strike, known as, quote, the March action. This was done without support from non-communist working workers, who were the majority, and often against their physical resistance. The adventure, the so-called March action, led to a severe defeat with many casualties. After this setback, Paul Levy published a harsh public condemnation of his party's rule. He was quickly expelled for this action, which came as no surprise to him. Zetkin had advised Levy against publishing this text, but when he did so, she defended his action and opposed his expulsion. Zetkin's own initiative, however, was rather different. She submitted a resolution to her party's central committee that presented Levy's essential points in the form of a proposed course of action for the party, leaving out the inflammatory attacks on the party and Comintern leaders. Lenin later hailed this text as a correct response. The text is in our book, To the Masses. Still, she was widely vilified in the party for her defense of Levy. The current she led had little support in the party ranks. Well, what do you think? Did she have any alternative? Could she have handled that situation better? Okay, third, Zetkin's appeal to the Congress. Because she defended Levy, Zetkin was isolated in her party, surrounded by what her biographer, Louise Dornemann, called a frigid wall of rejection, mistrust, and hostility, branded as an opportunist and a renegade. Zetkin felt herself dreadfully alone as never before in her life. Nonetheless, Zetkin organized a minority delegation to the Moscow Congress. They gathered extensive documentation of the March action errors, all of which was confiscated by the police at the border. Zetkin's opponents organized to prevent her from influencing the World Congress, which was to convene in Moscow in June. Now, the leader of the Comintern's ultra-left wing, Bela Kun, whom the Comintern had sent to Germany to help reorient the party there, and did so in a disastrous fashion, wrote Lenin on May 6th, warning him against Zetkin. Levy and Zetkin, he wrote, are utter hysterics, and what they are saying in the German party right now consists of nothing but lying gossip. You have to grasp that hysteric at the time was like a woman's disease. He continued, as for the statement of the aged comrade Zetkin, she was 63, despite all my sentimental feelings toward the old fighter, the old woman is suffering from senile dementia. She provides a living proof that Lafargue and his wife acted entirely correctly. Beside which Lenin wrote when he got the letter, tak, means so. Lafargue's wife, referred to here, was the daughter of Karl Marx. On reaching Zetkin's age, she had taken her life, convinced she had nothing further to offer the movement. 3 weeks later, the German delegation to the World Congress sent Lenin a collective warning. There is absolutely no objective foundation for the consideration that is being given here to the person of Clara Zetkin in deciding the tactical and organizational issues linked to the March action. In other words, don't listen to her. The message aimed to prevent Zetkin from gaining a hearing, either from Lenin or the Congress as a whole. And the German majority continued, any concession to the person of Comrade Clara Zetkin would severely damage the capacity for action and discipline of the communist movement in Germany. The German party leadership also attacked Zetkin at the Comintern Women's Conference, aiming to oust her from that post as head of the Communist Women's Movement. Later she wrote, "The goal of this shabby intrigue was to keep me from speaking with Lenin, and then to keep me outside the Congress." In poor health, she had been further weakened by the rigors of the trip to Moscow. Quote, "I was close to nervous collapse, but despite all the abuse, I hoped to hold out to the end." Well, she certainly did, and to see how she did, get our book. The whole text is there, both what she said in the Congress at great length and with great passion, and also in the private memos and letters that she wrote around that time. Zetkin was able to meet with Lenin and Trotsky and found them in agreement with her basic points. On the Congress floor, as the chief representative of the German minority, she was the target of harsh attacks. She voiced bold and far-reaching critique of the ultra-left theory proposed in defense of the March action, and during the debate, the intervention of Lenin and Trotsky, along with Zetkin's strong advocacy, gradually turned the tide. In a letter to Levy, Zetkin reported, "It seems that a page has been turned. At first, the minority representatives, we were treated like dead dogs, but now they wag their tails at us as if we were living creatures." The full letter's in the book. Indeed, toward the close of the Congress, Zetkin was honored by a unique tribute on the occasion of her birthday, led off by an effusive homage paid by her most bitter critic in the German party. Her campaign to win the World Congress had made great headway. Okay, my fourth point. The fourth point is the compromise outcome. No matter what was said in Moscow, the world movement could not turn on a dime. It was fundamentally a matter of the ranks, what they thought and what they could be convinced of and what they could be won to. As Lenin told Zetkin, "The Congress will wring the neck of the celebrated theory of the offensive," that was the ultra-left schema, "and will adopt a course of action corresponding to your ideas. In return, however, the Congress must grant the supporters of the offensive theory some crumbs of consolation. To do this," Lenin said, "in passing judgment on the March action, we will focus attention on the way that the proletarians provoked fought back against the lackeys of the bourgeoisie. Beyond that, we will let a somewhat fatherly leniency prevail." In other words, a compromise. For Zetkin, three aspects of this deal were hard to accept, and on each point, she pushed the limits of the agreement. The three points. The first was that enough was said in criticism of the March action to ensure that its example would not be emulated. Still, the Congress termed the March action, quote, "a step forward." Mm-hmm. However much this verdict was qualified, and it was hard to square with reality, and Zetkin portrayed the episode unsparingly as a catastrophe. Two, the expulsion of Levy was sustained, his appeal was suppressed. Zetkin openly protested against this procedure and privately convinced Lenin to offer Levy an avenue for his re-entry into the world movement, which, by the way, Levy did not accept. And three, the role of the executive in this tragedy was left unexamined. Three times, however, Zetkin broke the silence on this point, insisting that, and I quote, "Representatives of the executive bear a large part of the responsibility for the incorrect slogans, for the incorrect positions taken by the party. And no one knows this better than Karl Radek himself." Karl Radek had been the main representative of the executive in his dealings with the German party. Nonetheless, Zetkin accepted the broad framework of compromise on this and other points. Now, in my opinion, one can say that this course of events suggested that leadership responsibility was not being dealt with in an even-handed manner, and even perhaps that the executive itself was above criticism. Still, much was achieved, including the International's adoption of United Front policy 6 months later, which was the implication of what Zetkin was advocating. And Zetkin herself was integrated into a German leadership which was united, including some of her supporters and some of her previous opponents, united around a United Front perspective. In the book, my introduction to the book, To the Masses, I wrote that compromise was unavoidable. Quote, "It seemed a necessary goal, too often neglected in the socialist movement, of preserving the unity of revolutionary forces that was indispensable for further steps forward and providing a principled and broadly agreed basis for further united action and discussion." So, in conclusion, I have surveyed four turning points in Zetkin's course before and at the Third Congress. They were, once again, one, her resignation from the German party's leading body; two, her protest against the March action and in defense of Levy's pamphlet; three, her campaign to win the Third Congress to her view, including pushing against the limits of the compromise; and four, her qualified acceptance of the compromise reached at the Congress. I invite you to judge what you think of her course and her decisions.
Internal political struggles present both challenges and opportunities to Marxist organizations. This is especially true for their leaderships, which must be capable of conducting the debate in a way that doesn't undermine the organization, but rather strengthens it. In her review of To the Masses published in the ISR, Jen Roche focused on the political struggle at the Third Congress. Lenin played a leading role in this struggle, working closely with Trotsky and as John mentioned, about the role of Zetkin in the debate. Jen accurately conveyed the debates on the Congress floor over the so-called theory of the offensive put forward by partisans of the March action in Germany. And she went over how in their speeches, Lenin, Trotsky, and Zetkin brought clarity to the debate, refusing to accept a smoothed-over resolution that avoided the fundamental political issues at stake. In my contribution today, I want to come at this struggle from another vantage point, from the perspective of the way in which Lenin led the fight, and particularly how it relates to his conception of leadership in a revolutionary party. Lenin knew that for a revolutionary party to succeed, it needs experienced leaders who have been proven capable of standing on their own two feet. Having such a leadership can mean the difference between victory and defeat in a revolutionary struggle. Trotsky once made the observation that if neither Lenin nor he had been around in 1917, it's questionable whether the Bolsheviks could have emerged victorious. And this is where I believe the Paul Levy story fits in that John referred to, and Lenin's approach to it, which played a big role at the Third Congress. Levy had been the German CP's leader following the murder of Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. He had shown himself to be a capable, self-confident leader with sound judgment in political matters. It's something that Lenin recognized and appreciated. In 1921, this ability enabled Levy to see the disastrous nature of the March action. But as John referred to, what did he do during, what was his response? You know, right when the battle was still fresh, and the Communist Party was suffering severe repression, Levy wrote this scathing public criticism of its policy. And while many of the political points were correct, it was done in a way that was seen by most members as attacking the party as a whole, not just its leadership, without any sense of solidarity. And as a result, Levy was expelled for violating discipline and disloyal behavior. Now, Lenin recognized he had no choice but to support the expulsion, but he nevertheless hoped Levy could be restored not just to membership, but to the party leadership within 6 months or so. As Lenin told Zetkin, "We are not overblessed with talent, and we must strive to hold on to what we have." Lenin recognized that Levy was one of the few German CP leaders with sufficient experience and authority to lead the party forward. In fact, having been shown to have been correct in his criticisms of the March action, Levy's authority would have increased that much more. But Levy spurned Lenin's offer and walked away from the communist movement entirely. And for this, I believe he bears a heavy historical responsibility, regardless of any justifications he may or may not have had. His decision to walk away from the movement left a leadership gap that could not be easily filled. In fact, I would assert that this gap may well have contributed to the defeat of the German Revolution 2 years later in 1923. That summer, a revolutionary situation developed in Germany, which Bouet's book on the German Revolution describes. But the German CP was divided into warring factions and without any authoritative leadership. And neither of the two main wings was able to appreciate the revolutionary crisis or what to do about it. And as a result, the crisis passed without a real fight. It was a missed opportunity. Who knows what might have happened had Levy remained within the communist movement? Would having a capable leadership have made the difference? There's no way of knowing, of course, but we do know what happened without such a leadership. The Levy case posed not just the question of leadership capability, but also the question of leadership authority. In my opinion, preserving such authority was one of the underlying reasons behind Lenin's search for a compromise that John referred to. John read out how Lenin explained the compromise to Clara Zetkin about giving crumbs of consolation to the supporters of the March action. But why was Lenin so concerned about giving crumbs of consolation? Lenin recognized that for better or worse, the German party leadership that had carried out the March action was its leadership. It couldn't simply be replaced in Moscow. And rather than leaving this leadership discredited and stripped of authority, Lenin hoped to preserve some of it, looking to the future. He was hoping that new developments could bring about either the elimination of the two factions altogether or at least a realignment of positions. Lenin's view that once his political line triumphed, he would try to leave the door open for his adversaries to come over to his position, which would offer the possibility of letting new developments pose the questions in new ways, out of which they could be convinced. And that's exactly what happened. A little over 6 months later, when the Comintern launched its United Front initiative, it led to a new debate, and in that debate, most of the former adversaries of the Third Congress did indeed come over to his position. The outcome of the Third Congress debate shows the advantages of an inclusive leadership, one that includes the different sides in an internal debate. The benefits of such a leadership are twofold. One, so that all members have confidence that the leadership represents them, and secondly, so that the leadership has its finger on the pulse of the membership. With that in mind, I want to call attention to an item in the appendix section of To the Masses, a transcript of a discussion that Lenin and Trotsky had with the two opposing factions in the German CP, which eventually came up with a so-called, what they called, peace treaty. What's interesting is Lenin and Trotsky's concern with ensuring that the minority led by Zetkin be represented on the Central Committee and Political Bureau. They didn't want leadership bodies that excluded an important section of the party membership. Lenin and Trotsky also understood that one advantage of an inclusive leadership was to compel the minority to take responsibility for the decisions of the party as a whole. It also creates the best conditions to prevent the factions from hardening and becoming permanent. Permanent factionalism is a disease. The lifeblood of a revolutionary movement is free and open discussion of political perspectives, which on the occasion can lead to the formation of factions and tendencies. In a healthy organization, these usually disappear after the debate is concluded. But if factions begin to take on a life of their own, independently of the political issues that gave birth to them, the consequences can be deadly. James P. Cannon's book on the first 10 years of American communism gives an example of how destructive permanent factionalism was to the American Communist Party in the 1920s. In this regard, I want to call attention to the lineup of forces during the debate at the Third Congress. Most of the delegations were divided, including the Russians, which at least initially it was Zinoviev, Bukharin, and Roddick versus Lenin and Trotsky. It's worth thinking about this just for a second. Zinoviev, for a number of years, had been Lenin's closest collaborator within the Bolshevik Party, whereas Trotsky, for a dozen years prior to 1917, had been Lenin's fierce political opponent. It's a small example of how Lenin had no permanent allies or adversaries in internal debates. Whatever position you may have held last year or last month in an earlier debate was of little importance to him in new debates. And permanent factionalism was definitely not a feature of the Bolshevik Party under Lenin. One of the things that made this type of realignment possible was Lenin's understanding of the importance of comradeship in a revolutionary party. Comradeship, as we know, is different from friendship. Bonds of solidarity are crucial in a revolutionary party, whereas things develop, members may well have to trust their lives to one another. When this trust breaks down, it can literally tear an organization apart. It's one of the reasons, as John pointed out, that Lenin was so concerned about the campaign of denigration against Zetkin. He was horrified by Bella Kuhn's letter that refused to even refer to her as a comrade. And it explains the birthday tribute that John talked about. And this view of comradeship also explains Lenin's care in avoiding personal attacks. Throughout his political life, Lenin's polemics could be extremely harsh, with sharp and even brutal political characterizations. But he never resorted to casting personal aspersions. Lenin understood that subjective antipathies, if allowed to fester, could obstruct political collaboration. And that understanding was on full display at the Third Congress. In the appendix section, there's a note Lenin wrote to some delegates apologizing for harsh language he had used against them in the debate. And while his words were not personal in nature, Lenin was still determined to eliminate unnecessary obstacles to collaboration. And if you've read To the Masses, you'll realize this was definitely not the case with everybody at the Third Congress, to say the least. To sum up, Lenin was a leading protagonist in the political debate. He fought for his point of view and refused to settle for a mishmash of positions, insisting on political clarity. At the same time, he sought to guide the debate so that it didn't result in a split, and he allowed his adversaries the opportunity to eventually come over to his position. All throughout, he was guided by his conception of leadership norms and responsibilities, the importance of leadership capability and authority, an inclusive leadership, the danger of permanent factionalism, the value of comradeship in an atmosphere free of personal animosities. I'll end with this general observation. The experience of most left organizations with regard to internal struggles is not very positive. But the Third Congress debate shows that internal political struggles can have positive outcomes, that they can even strengthen a movement. Sometimes they lead to splits, sometimes not. Marxists certainly don't fear splits, which are sometimes necessary, but unnecessary ones can leave lasting damage. The Third Congress shows important aspects of Lenin's conception of leadership in a revolutionary party. We can learn from this just as we can from the political debate at the Congress. Of course, like anything else involving the Third Congress, no one can mechanically copy anything in it, ignoring concrete conditions of the class struggle today or the situation of any specific organization. But just as with the political lessons found in To the Masses, Lenin's approach to the leadership question and how the debate was conducted also deserves study. Thank you.
No, very, very interesting. I guess I wanted to do a couple things. I first wanted to sort of pull the lens back and give a little bit of the context, because we've sort of dug deep into the debates at the Congress. But this whole period, I think, is a very challenging period. From the Russian Revolution through 1923 was a period in which the question of world revolution was on the agenda. The fate of history hung in the balance. And the new parties that emerged, not just in Germany, but across Europe, and especially the Bolshevik leaders who represented the most experienced, cohesive elements, had a series of enormously difficult tasks that they were trying to achieve at once and were often in conflict and tension with one another. And I think that that provides the sort of backdrop to a lot of the debates and how questions were approached at the Third Congress. I want to just outline what I think some of those tasks were. First and foremost, they were trying to develop strategy and tactics to advance the revolutionary movement in a period of very concentrated, intense activity, and one that had very sharp tax in terms. So the Third Congress is taking place in kind of a period of retreat after the first revolutionary onslaught, and the question of how do we begin to move things forward in this period weighs very heavily on the parties. Secondly, they're trying to bring together a cohesive leadership that can debate fully but achieve unity in practice, again, under those intense pressured conditions. And third, and I think this has to be brought into the discussion, they're doing so in the context of a besieged revolution in Russia that knew it had to break beyond the bounds of Russia if it was going to be successful. So that's a tall order for anybody. And so I think that that has to be understood when we're talking about the challenges of how Lenin and Trotsky and Zekin handled the debates at the Third Congress. And I really appreciate how Mike and John have focused on this question of leadership, as it's one of my main interests in reading this. And I think if I really would recommend people go and read through the proceedings and read the debates, because it just gives you a much richer sense. But I would like to bring, I guess, maybe some different elements and perhaps, as John said, different perspective to this discussion that I don't think is necessarily a critique, but maybe rounding out the discussion. In his writings and other talks, John has made a really convincing argument, I think is one of the main contributions that you get from reading some of this, that you can't just view the discussions and debates that took place purely through the lens of the Russian party, but there were whole layers of leadership that existed outside of Russia. There were rich debates that existed. And I think John's made a really convincing argument that the main pressure for action, that is the March Act, the disastrous March action in Germany, and the impulse towards ultra-leftism in Germany came from within the ranks of the German party itself. Like, whereas it's mostly tended to be seen as sort of bellicoon coming from the outside and cooking up, you know, this plot, John makes an argument that actually there's an impulse towards ultra-leftism that's built into the situation, and that the development of an impatient layer of revolutionary workers who don't yet know how to relate to the workers who haven't quite gotten there yet and are still tied to their reformist leaderships is a question that we're going to have to confront over and over again. So it's not just a question of like, well, hopefully we won't have a bellicoon. We're going to be dealing with these exact same pressures. And I think that that's a really important point that John has made. But I also think while that main pressure for action came from within the German party itself, it's also clear that the executive committee representatives at the very least played a role in encouraging the March action. And I think that the role of the executive committee and the debate around it at the Third Congress has to be brought into this picture as well, because I don't think it's just about the German party leadership. It's also about the Russian leadership and what they were dealing with. Both Bellicoon and Radek argued for a more activist policies, one in which party members would launch actions with or without the support of larger sections of the working class. And while I would argue there's no evidence for the idea that the March action was planned in Moscow in order to aid Soviet Russia, which is one of the, you know, ideas that's widely held, it's true that both Radek and Kuhn expressed the urgency of breaking Russia's isolation and linked this to the need for Germans to move over to the offensive. So, for example, Kuhn, Bela Kuhn, thinking he was providing a defense of his position, wrote to Lenin, quote, "Here's what I actually told Levy. Soviet Russia is in great peril. You are well aware of Soviet Russia's importance for the world revolution and of what a disaster it would be for the Soviet state to fall. When you consider what it would mean, sorry, I have a cold, if the absence of the world revolution causes Soviet Russia to fall in 2 years, you must reorient your line of march to break through the counter-revolutionary front. Do not wait standing on the defensive while the bourgeoisie strangles the proletariat through capitalist restoration." And similarly, Radek wrote to the German leadership in March saying that the situation in Russia was dire and that, quote, "help from abroad was very necessary to raise confidence here in Russia among the masses." He goes on to argue that Levy must be isolated and that the leadership must pursue a more activist course. Now, I don't think this takes away from John's main points that the March action can't be attributed to either the personality of Abela Kun or simply a reflection of a bureaucratic centralization of power in Moscow. But it does point to the extreme pressure of events, not only the pressure from a layer of impatient workers in Germany, but also the pressure of a revolution in danger in Russia. And these pressures greatly constrain the options facing Lenin and Trotsky. They went into the Congress needing to accomplish two somewhat contradictory goals, which I think John and Mike have laid out. The primary task was to unequivocally reject the theory of the offensive and win the Congress to an orientation on winning the masses. That strategy had to be won, otherwise they were going down to defeat, period. They also needed to come out of the conference with a clear basis for future what would be called united front work. That term was developed later. At the same time, they wanted to win the greatest possible unity with as few losses as possible, what Mike spoke to, the danger of a split in these new parties. They had already lost half their forces in Germany as a result of the March action, and they were presented with the difficulty of their own comrades' role in the March action. So they needed to win over the Russian comrades if they had any hope of winning the Congress, and they desperately needed to avoid a split. This meant a fight within their own delegation to take a stand against the ultra-lefts. In order to win Zinoviev and Radek, who would then need to win over the German leadership, they were forced to make a series of compromises. So I don't think it was simply a matter of preserving the German leadership, but it was also about preserving the Russian leadership and being able to maintain the cohesion of the Bolshevik delegation that went into the Third Congress with a lot of debate. Daniela didn't mention it, but the work that Mike is editing is actually the proceedings of the executive committee. So I'm very interested to read those, because I'm sure they will be very sharp debates. But Zekin noted to Levy in a letter that, quote, clearly the executive wants the German question to be dealt with as much as possible, the dirty laundry within the German delegation. And it's clear that this was allowed. John pointed out in his introduction that in a Congress notable for candor and controversy, almost nothing was said in criticism of the ECCI's record, including of the discussion of the ECCI report, which unanimously adopted resolution on the ECCI's actions, including with regards to Germany, unqualified approval. Zekin was the only comrade to raise an open criticism of the ECCI on the convention floor. And this really represented a departure from the historic practice of the Bolshevik Party, which was characterized by a high level of sharp and open debate. And it's difficult to judge the exact reasons for this. Obviously, there was the need to win over Radek and Zinoviev, and there was a desire to save face on all sides. That's very clear when you read Radek's report. It's also the case that the Bolsheviks, who had come to rule despite their intentions as a one-party state in Russia, were very vulnerable to any splits in their central leadership. And all of these elements must have played a role, and it's arguable that this compromise was necessary in the specific conditions. But it also has to be acknowledged that it set a dangerous precedent for the Comintern and for how subsequent generations of revolutionaries could come to develop a distorted understanding of the organizational principles of Bolshevism. John and Mike outlined the contours of the compromise. I would say that in many ways, this compromise would be unsatisfying to comrades on all sides. It would be tenuous, and it involved a series of concessions. And as rich as the discussions of the Third Congress were, I believe the compromise was strained to the breaking point on the Congress floor and often resulted in a muddled discussion that had to be clarified by Lenin and Trotsky and Zekin. Constantly, they were the ones who came back and said, whoa, 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 we cannot compromise anymore. These amendments that are being raised, there were these amendments being raised that were unacceptable. Trotsky in particular gave a very sharp speech that led to a complaint from six of the delegation, saying they agreed with the theses in their entirety, but they objected to Trotsky's speech defending the theses. And I think one of the great values of John's volume is that it provides supplementary materials that illuminate many of the questions. And so John and Mike have pointed out correctly that the Congress provided an important basis for unity, but I would argue it also came at a cost too. In a letter to Levy, Zekin insightfully remarked that, quote, the most distressing and despicable thing is that the decision will not be based on political insight and conviction by the many, but rather on the fundamental clarity and firmness, the insight and political intelligence of Trotsky and Lenin, especially of Lenin alone. So Lenin and Trotsky were able, through a combination of their personal prestige and their political arguments, to win the Congress delegates to a new course. However, it's not clear whether the comrades themselves fully absorbed the lessons of their mistakes. Moreover, while the intervention of the Russian leaders was absolutely essential, it had a negative side as well. The German leadership lost confidence in itself and became hesitant as a result of its prior mistakes. Thus, despite carrying out the policy of the Third Congress in exemplary fashion, they were ill-prepared when the opportunity to move over to the offensive action did present itself with tragic results. And I would say that the problem here is not a gulf in competence, but a gulf in experience. The experience of a party, and most especially its cadre and leadership, being tested over a period of time. One of the most fascinating and thought-provoking aspects of the material in this volume is the different approaches to the debate that are argued by Zekin and Lenin, which I think Mike and John have gone through. Both are insightful revolutionary leaders with great respect for one another, which makes their debate all the more challenging. Zekin is clearly in favor of a much more open and public debate. In the discussion of strategy and tactics, she makes this case. She first argues for conducting debates before the whole class, not just party members, stressing their educational nature. She says, "I firmly believe that criticisms of the errors and mistakes must not be restricted to the party organization and party press. Our workers themselves demand that the errors and weaknesses of the party be openly discussed, because such debates, if conducted objectively, are educational and enlightening them for them as well." She goes on to say, "In closing, I do not believe that we should engage in efforts to reconcile individuals with each other and to hush things up." "All of us as individuals count for nothing compared to the revolution. What is at issue is to create a principled foundation from which the Communist Party of Germany can look forward to its greatest future battles." So for Zekin, the sharpest, most open debate possible was necessary to clarify the issues and learn from mistakes. Now, Lenin could hardly be described as someone who shied away from debate, but he argued, as Mike put forward very well, that the ground had to be prepared for a compromise in order to win people over. And I think that Lenin's arguments have to be taken seriously. Animating his approach is a sense of urgency, but also a concern that the Comintern not lose more forces. He's also identifying another dynamic, the need to pay close attention to the developing revolutionary sense of a layer of workers who may be impatient but can be won. This is an important element that has to be understood in order to develop a full picture. But most of all, I would argue, what one is struck by when reading through the proceedings is the enormous difficulty of forging a unified, collaborative leadership under the pressure of revolutionary events. In a letter, and I'm going to end with this, to the German Congress, which took place following the Third Congress, Lenin offers a vivid account of what it takes to build such a leadership. "The training of experienced and influential party leaders is a long and difficult job, and without it, the dictatorship of the proletariat and its unity of will remain a phrase. In Russia, it took us 15 years to produce a group of leaders. 15 years of fighting Menshevism, 15 years of Tsarist persecution, 15 years which included the years of the first revolution, 1905, a great and mighty revolution." And through the Comintern, the Bolsheviks attempted to accelerate this process and transmit their own experience to the new parties. But too much, people tried to take the letter of Bolshevism, but without absorbing the actual experience and lessons. And I think you could argue that that would be impossible to do in the concentrated period of 1917 to 1923. And one of the biggest lessons we can take from this is the need to prepare and develop that experience and those lessons over a longer period of time before the impact of those revolutionary upheavals.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.